I had no concept of what it was actually like for a truckload of grief to hit you and floor you. You know what I mean? I had no concept of that at all. That was unexpected. I didn't know that was coming. And as a consequence, I then understood much better when people came in to me. I had thought I understood their grieving process, but I didn't really. I didn't really till I went through it. And then I went, oh my God, it's so much worse than I had ever understood it to be.
Hello and welcome. My name is Liz Gleeson, and you're listening to Shapes of Grief. Shapes of Grief is a curation of stories from ordinary people on their experience of loss, how their grief impacted them, and what helped them to find their feet again. Loss can really have such a profound effect on our lives, and it is my hope that Shapes of Grief will provide comfort, hope, and inspiration to our listeners, so that together we can get more comfortable talking about grief. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a patron of Shapes of Grief on patreon.com. This is a listener-supported podcast, so please do donate, like, share, and review. It really does keep us going. For more grief resources and grief support, find and follow us on all the usual social media channels and on shapesofgrief.com. Welcome to this week's episode of Shapes of Grief, and I'm delighted to be here with Dr. Ciara Kelly, who is my neighbour from Greystones. Ciara has an interesting background. You're a GP for how many years?
I was in clinical practice for 20 years as a doctor.
20 years.
Yeah, I worked mostly as a GP, but I also did work as a psychiatrist in my early career.
Okay, well, you're really welcome, Ciara.
Thank you.
I know you're a household name at this stage in Ireland, but we actually have a lot of listeners outside of Ireland. So for those who don't know you, would you give us a little bit of your background, Ciara? Tell us a bit about yourself.
I'm a medical doctor. And as I said, I practiced medicine for 20 years. And then in 2017, which is about a year and a half ago now, I left clinical practice and went full-time into working in the media. I had been working anyway, sort of part-time in the media for maybe the last 10 years. I have a column in Sunday Independent, so I write, and I would have worked quite a lot in Irish television, and then I would have done a lot of radio. I would have been a contributor on a lot of radio sort of shows, but then a couple of years ago I got my own weekend show, but about a year and a half ago I was offered a daytime kind of full-time radio job. So I put down my stethoscope and picked up a microphone and went full-time into broadcasting, and that's what I do now. I work in the media, and I'm no longer, well, I am still a doctor. Yeah, I haven't, you know, I still have the title. I'm still qualified, but I don't practice medicine anymore. I now am a broadcaster and a journalist. Mm.
And was that a steep learning curve, or did you just take to it like a
duck
to water?
No, it was a totally steep learning curve, Liz, okay. Really. And it was kind of a weird one as well, because I would have been a very, 20 years in the job as a doctor. I was an experienced doctor. I wasn't a junior doctor or a particularly young doctor. So I know I was that. And I also, because I worked in health journalism as well as practicing medicine, I was sort of considered vaguely expert, you know, and I would be asked onto TV to discuss things and everything. So I was kind of considered an authority in what I do, and I would have kind of reached, a fairly respected, and maybe you might say, position in that. And then I went into a new career entirely where I was absolutely a novice. And it was a very odd thing to go from being sort of on top of your game completely to like not knowing how anything worked. And it was probably very good to challenge yourself, because it was a totally different, it's a different animal in every way. And it was probably very good to do that, but it definitely was like changing horses and changing speeds and changing everything. And I suppose it gave me a certain amount of insight. I've never been out of the workforce. I always worked, even though I had a family and everything, I always worked when the kids were small and all that. But it gave me some insight into what it must be like for a lot of women who are my age, who come back into the workforce, maybe having been out of the workforce, which is the same thing. It's just changing career. You know, you're in the home doing whatever you're doing, and then you go into a different sort of a pay job outside the home, and you're suddenly, you know, it's daunting. And so I feel like maybe I gave me a bit of insight into what that must be like, because I did kind of go, oh my God, what have I done? What have I done doing this?
Because a lot of those panels you were invited onto and your column in The Independent, I'm right in saying they're all health related. They were, whereas now you talk about anything.
Oh yeah.
From politics to yoga.
And that's probably about sums it up. They were mostly health, and they certainly were initially health and exclusively health, really, in the beginning. I started to branch out then over the years, largely through News Talk, where I still work and where I have my radio show. But when I was a contributor in News Talk, I would have been a regular guest on a show called The Right Hook with George Hook. And I started off in that in kind of health punditry, if you like, or health journalism. Mm. But George and I had a good rapport, and he started asking me on about other things, about feminism or about working women or about parenting or about anything to do with modern life, which was something he didn't have really much of a clue about, to be honest. And so he would ask me on to talk about all sorts of different things. And from there, his show was different on a Friday. It was called The Friday Right Hook. And there was a regular panel every Friday. There was George Hook. And then he had two panelists, Shane Coleman, who's a political journalist, and Dave McIntyre, who's a sports journalist. And the three of them did the show like a three-hand reel every Friday. And for whatever reason, over time, I became first sub. So if one of them was off, I'd step in and I'd become the filler in. And then after doing that for quite a while, I don't really know how long, they expanded that panel to a panel of four, and I was the fourth. So for about a year and a half or 2 years, every Friday, I did 2.5 hours of live radio. And that was news related. So that was, we could be talking about anything from, you know, trains running late to unemployment to the Dáil to but also equally pop culture to anything at all. And I loved that, and it's probably what swung me towards thinking about a change of career, because that was very possibly one of my favourite jobs ever, that Friday afternoon.
I mean, you light
job.
Up when you're talking about it, you know.
I loved
it. And 20 years in one position or doing similar day in, day out. I mean, we all need change.
In particular need change. I crave change. I crave variety and stimulation and new things a little bit. I have a kind of a, and I'm not saying I was bored at medicine, because you couldn't really get bored at medicine. It was too varied and it was too interesting and there was too much depth to it. But 20 years is a long time to do anything. So I was kind of ripe for change.
And it's a predictable trajectory, albeit an interesting one.
Well, a weird one, as a lot of people might say, but yes. So I was doing that job and I absolutely loved it. And Dave and Shane and George and I had a really good chemistry, the four of us. We were all really good friends. We were all very different. And we would fight it out for 2.5 hours. We would debate. And very often, actually, it ended up me against the three of them. And I still loved it. And it was great fun. And we've all stayed really good friends. But what was kind of interesting about that for me when I was thinking about it, they were all full-time journalists and full-time broadcasters, and I was a full-time GP who popped into News Talk of a Friday afternoon. And yet, I was kind of holding my own, and I was kind of enjoying it, and I kind of went, God, these people do this as their job all the time. Some people, this is their job, and it's so much fun. And that, I suppose, started the germ of an idea. That
Did you ever have imposter syndrome in the middle of these professional journalists?
Probably not as much as most people do. I am weird. I'm particularly, I think, weird as a woman, because I know from all the studies, and I've talked about this enough with other women, I don't struggle with imposter syndrome. I do to an extent, but not as much as it seems to me a lot of people do. And I would feel absolutely comfortable taking on three full-time broadcasters in the broadcast medium of a Friday afternoon and holding all three of them to task sometimes. So like I obviously was pretty balshy in my own way.
Where did that balshiness come from, Kira?
It's always been there, Liz, to be honest. I don't think I was much different as a teenager to how I... In fact, I often feel my 40s has been a reconnection with my teens in a way, because I was full of debate and ideas and opinion as a teenager. I quite liked, you know, school debates and all that stuff when I was young. And then I think my 20s was occupied largely with being doing medicine and being a junior doctor, which is a grind. I mean, there was I had jobs where I worked 120 hours a week. There only is 160 something hours in a week. Do you know what I mean? So it was absolutely crazy in a way. I don't even know how many hours, but there's not very many over 120. And so we worked like dogs. And so I never, you know, you had your nose to the grindstone for that period of time. And then I think a lot of, like a lot of people, you're 30s, my 30s was occupied with getting a house and having small children and all that. And so I would say there was a good 15 years where I never really thought about what I wanted to do or thought about myself very much at all. I'd nearly have said I was becoming a bit invisible to me. But then, and when you're in that phase, I do think that you think that that's how life will always be, that this is life now. And you don't recognize, because you're not old enough at that point to recognize that life has phases. And now my youngest child is 10 and I'm at a whole different stage again where I have much more time for me, even though I'm busy. And I do get to think about what maybe I want to do or where I want to go with things or all of that sort of stuff.
And so, boy, did you relaunch yourself.
Well, it wasn't really a plan. I mean, it all kind of happened. Serendipitously and accidentally, but I mean,
but
I was
also you were open to it.
I was very open to the opportunity and to the idea of change, and I was also moving in a direction. I suppose, look, with hindsight, I was obviously moving in a direction, but when you're moving in a direction, you don't really know. You know what I mean? It's like hindsight's a wonderful way of appreciating what you did and didn't do in your life, but when you're going through it, you're just muddling along. But yeah, I have had a weird career. There's no two ways about it. And no, there's a one thing they talk about women is women are terrible with imposter syndrome, and I'm not really. And the other thing that they talk about women, they say the difference between women and men and jobs is a man will apply for a job literally that he's 30, maybe 40% qualified for, whereas women need to be 80 or 90% or they don't have the confidence. Not me. I'm such a chancer. I literally, look at me, I went for a radio job, wasn't qualified for it at all. Do you know what I mean? I literally had no, and I was told that at one point in News Talk, because I said, you know, I think I'd like to do more of this. And they said, well, we really only hire journalists and, you know, people with broadcast experience in that way. And they were saying, you see what we're saying. And I said, yeah, I see. And then I more or less said, and you'll see too. And I was always kind of somebody who thought,
I mean, it's a personality, isn't it? It's a personality kind of type as well. And
but you can't change your personality. I don't think I could fake this, if you know what I mean.
Yeah,
I don't think I could kind of go, oh, just talk myself. I kind of just kind of go, do you know what? If I want to try something, I'll tend to try and make that happen.
Hi, everyone. Excuse this brief interruption. It's Liz here, and I wanted to tell you about my grief training program. If you are interested in becoming grief literate or grief trained, I've designed a comprehensive online program which you can do at your own pace in your own time. It's been designed primarily for healthcare providers, but we all have a right to grief training and education. So if you're interested, then it's for you too. Sign up today at shapesofgrief.com. Now, back to the podcast. And do you fail well? Try something and it doesn't work out.
That's okay. I'm okay with that.
You fail well.
It wouldn't make me go, oh! Probably, in fact, would kind of just barely notice, because I don't see, you know what, I have a friend who is a journalist who said that she always thought that I was very odd because she said I didn't recognise the concept of failure. And I know what she meant, because I don't tend to see things as failures. I tend to see things as setbacks. So that's a setback now. So now we need to get over the setback and keep, you know what I mean? I see things as mere...
Whereas someone else might shrink and go, it's not
for me. No, I kind of go, oh, whatever, that didn't, you know, now, obviously I have to change course a little bit now or get over that or get around that, but I don't know.
Well, I want to take you back, Kira, to the medical days.
Go on.
And then also to move you forward a little bit to your own personal life and your experiences with your mom that you've written about recently. So I guess, first of all, from a professional level, as a doctor, you're on Shapes of Grief. This is what we're talking about. What was your experience of, you know, breaking bad news, being with people through the dying process, supporting people who were bereaved? What was your relationship as a medical professional?
They're two different things. The breaking the bad news is one thing.
Yeah.
And then the dealing with the bereaved is another.
And then the dying process as well.
Yeah. And that's probably another thing too. We're certainly taught and talked through the idea of breaking the bad news. That's part of medical training. And you do have to do it. And it's shit. It's a shit thing to have to do. It's a really awful thing to break that news to somebody, because particularly if the kind of, I mean, we give bad diagnoses all the time, but if you're given something like a terminal diagnosis, that's real, that it's not in question in any way, you're changing someone's life forever. It's a horrific thing to do, and trying to do it sensitively and decently is a challenge that I think all humans, never mind doctors, all humans would find that very difficult.
Did you get training or support?
We did get some training. I would say we probably didn't get adequate support, but I was a junior doctor in the late 90s, so it's a while ago now. It's probably marginally better now, and probably only marginally better.
Actually, I heard that the Gaiety School of Acting is doing empathy classes with doctors.
We always did role play and stuff like that. That was always part of training. So you would practice, because it's probably as well, but I can still remember the first time. I can remember the woman's name and everything. I can remember the room
that you broke bad news.
Yeah, and I was an intern, which means I was barely qualified.
Yeah.
It was my first job.
How old were you?
I would have been 26, I think.
Wow.
Yeah, I think I was 26.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the summer of 1997, which means I was 26. And we were in the Mater Hospital, and we were a part of a medical team. And normally who breaks the bad news would be a consultant. That's the norm, not junior doctors. But our consultant was away. And actually the other members of the team were all away. It was really myself and a registrar. We were down to small numbers, as was often the case in Irish hospitals. So there was two of us there, and she was more senior than me, but probably a similar age, and equally probably slightly out of her depth personally and all of that kind of stuff, because it's not like people get really good at it. And what had happened was we had been on call, which means our team had taken all the admissions in a 24-hour period from A&E. That's what being on call means. Your team is on call, so anybody who comes in and is admitted through A&E for that 24 hours is your team. Mm. And this woman was 33 years old, and she had come in and she had had a pain in her tummy and some bleeding from her. I think she probably had vomited some blood. And the norm for that would be that somebody would have, in her age group, would be an ulcer. That would be the commonest diagnosis there. I mean, there's other things too, but that was common. And you'd expect that. And so she came in, she was unwell. They stuck a camera down expecting an ulcer. And what they actually found was not only a gastric cancer, but a very advanced gastric cancer. So she was going to die, and there was nothing that could happen there that was going to change that. And she also, because they had then scanned and stuff, and we knew exactly where we were, that it was quite advanced and it had spread. And this young woman did not have very much time. And she would have been a woman who would have been a medical card patient, north inner city Dublin, not a lot of money, from a deprived kind of an area, all of that kind of stuff. But despite those things, she would normally have been left in A&E probably for ages, but she got a private room in the hospital largely because they were going to give her a bit of space and a bit of peace, because this was a terrible diagnosis. But she still didn't know. And we went in, we stood outside the door for a while, myself and the registrar, going, how are we going to say this to her?
Mm.
And
made the decision that she had to be told?
Well, that was a given. You couldn't, I mean, she was going to go through treatment, and she was probably, I don't think that surgery was an option, but she was probably going to have some chemo and we were about to start cancer treatment for a terminal cancer, and there's no hiding that from somebody. So I think we had gotten the nurses to tell us when her family were there, because you wanted somebody with her. And we were outside the door and we were discussing going in, and both of us felt sick at the idea of doing this. And as I say, usually it would be more senior doctors that would do it, but there was nobody else there this day. And we went into the room, and unfortunately the family that she had with her was her husband and her two very small children, 2 and 3 I'd say they were, who were playing around the floor of the room.
Yeah.
And her husband was from somewhere else, Middle Eastern I think he was, and had very poor English. So he hadn't a clue what was going on. He had really poor English. And so she more or less got this news from us on her own, because the kids were unaware, and he was kind of looking, and she was kind of having to explain it to him. It wasn't like he was there reading between the lines, and it was a really unusual situation.
Yeah, particularly with the two toddlers there in the room as well.
But I will never forget it, really, for the reason that we sat on the bed, and you know how you break bad news to somebody is you tell them the truth. You tell them as gently as you can, but there's not an awful lot to be gained from euphemism or fudging it or whatever. We said,
making it softer.
No, yeah. We make it as soft. We held her hand. We said, it's not an ulcer, which is what she'd been told it probably was going to be. It's actually a cancer, and it's a bad cancer. And she looked at us and she said, am I going to die? And I could see her looking at her children, just looking from child to child. And we said, yes, you are. And she didn't miss a beat, Liz. She just looked at us and she said, I want you to help me. And we said, oh, of course, we'll do whatever we can, and the treatment. And she goes, no. I want you to help me. You need to help me get a house for my family. And that's all she said. She literally went straight into, it wasn't about her. Yeah. It was about protecting her husband with no English and her two kids and what needed to be done to protect her family. And we were floored, to be honest. The two of us came out, and even now I can feel the tears behind my eyes. She was so brave. She was so stoic. And it really was not about her. She was selfless in this situation. And it was awful. And I remember to this, I'm not going to say her name because she probably has family that could potentially hear this podcast one day. But I will never forget her face or her name or any of it. I can still see the room. And so that, you know, you do remember these moments, because medicine is a weird job. It's not like other jobs. There's very little bullshit in it. Do you know what I mean? It's real. It's real conversations. It's not small talk. It's not cocktail chatter or that kind of thing. It's like taking off our masks and talking to each other in a way we don't talk maybe socially. And so that was certainly one aspect of dealing with breaking the bad news. Is a job we all hate because it makes you sick. It just makes it eats away at you. And then I think, obviously, going through the dying with somebody is a different thing. Palliation and palliative care and trying to ease pain and all of that. But a lot of doing that, the people that you're dealing with a lot of the time are older. And there is a lot of the happy release idea that somebody is older and in pain or maybe has an illness and maybe it's their time. And there's a lot of that. It is definitely a different death when it's somebody young or before their time or those things. So I think there is all of that. And then obviously I have dealt with and had always dealt with, particularly as a GP, people coming into me who were bereaved. And that was a regular enough occurrence. But I would have to say, I don't think that I fully understood how awful it was until I was bereaved myself, even though I'd seen people go through it time and time and time again. I still don't think I understood how bad it was.
And was your mum's death your first really significant bereavement?
No, my mum and my dad are dead, and my dad had died in 2002. My mum died in 2017, so it was 15 years after dad had died. And they were very different deaths as well. But I think until I had experienced bereavement and loss and grief and those things, I don't think I had a full insight into it, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
And funnily enough, although you wouldn't wish it upon yourself in order for this to happen, I do think that I became a better doctor for having experienced things. In the same way, I probably became a better doctor after I had kids. I became a better doctor after I lost somebody. I became a better doctor with life experience, because the more life experience you have, the better your insight and your understanding, and maybe also your empathy for other people, because you understand better, perhaps.
You drop down to a different level of being.
You understand maybe the road other people walk a little bit better.
Was it your father's death that...
My father's death was the first death that struck me. And actually, I wrote about that, but you may not have read those things, because I wrote about those some years ago. Long after he had died, I never said a word about it for years, because I would have found it quite difficult to. He died quite suddenly. Mum died after a long period of, like, she was 91. She'd been maybe struggling with dementia for the last, probably reasonably significantly, for the last 3 years of her life. But I think by anyone's sort of standards, 91 is a good innings. And she was comfortable and she died in her own bed and it was peaceful and it was all of that. And
it was also, in time. It had
it was
time,
in time.
Yeah.
And because I think as well with the dementia and so much of her faculties had already gone, that I think we were all at peace with her dying, even though it's, you'd never really expect anyone to die, Liz, even though you might be in the room thinking, yes, she's probably dying, you still don't actually expect them to die. It's yeah, a very odd thing.
I know it.
But my dad was 66 and was playing around a golf and had got a bit of mild chest pain and was, ooh, a bit of chest pain. And you know the way, he was a man in his 60s, so I better go into A&E, but I don't know, probably grand, bit of indigestion. And they did all the tests and they said, actually, you have like a mild heart attack, but not we'd barely called it a heart attack. They called it a STEMI, which is a medical term. So it was kind of a mild thing. And they said, but you know what, we've done an angio and you probably need to have a bypass. And, you know, you're fine and it's not a big thing. And the mortality post-bypass is 3%. It's 97% of people go on and never look back. It's all good. But he had a bypass and dropped dead a couple of days after the surgery. So
you're 15 years younger at this
point. Yeah, I was 30.
A
I
lot
think
less
I was.
Life experience.
Oh, yeah, I think I was 30. Was I?
No. Small children at home?
Ella, my then youngest child, was 6 weeks or 10 weeks or something. Oh. She was a babe in arms, like she was tiny. She wasn't even, I don't think she was 3 months old at the time.
So you're in a totally different zone to the rest of the world at that
point. Absolute shock, because we didn't expect it. I think he was due to be discharged the next day. I think that he was due out of the hospital and all fine. And I'd been talking to him on the phone the night before and chatting away. And he was sort of saying, I can't wait to get out of this place. And, you know, all the usual kind of jazz. And then I had been in Italy. I had flown home when I was on maternity leave with Ella. We had flown to Italy to spend 6 weeks in Italy having La Dolce Vita because we were off and we were young and those are the kind of things you did.
And Ella was 6 weeks old, you said?
Yeah. Oh. And went off. Maybe Ella was 3 months because maybe I went out when she was 6 weeks and maybe this is about 6 weeks later. But basically, he had the heart attack. I flew home to make sure he was okay and everything, he was fine. And I actually flew back to Italy for a few days because Owen and Oisin, who was my eldest, who at the time was two, was in Italy. And then we came back and we were in our kitchen having just driven in and come home from the airport. So I was in the door, I don't know, half an hour or something in the kitchen, and I was having a cup of tea, as you do when you come home from your holidays. And we'd been away for weeks and weeks. And the phone rang. And I'm not the most observant. And I was like, oh, the phone's ringing. And I was thinking I'm not even answering it. I thought, oh, sure, because I was kind of chatting. And I think it was probably Owen said, it's like 3 a.m. Do you not think you should answer the phone? I think he probably twigged there was something off before I did. And I was like, okay, yeah. And it was a phone call to say that, could I come into the matter that Dad had taken a turn for the worst? And I was like, okay. And I'm quite the optimist, not the pessimist. And I went, oh, okay, it's the middle of the night. It never struck me that this could go.
This is the funny thing that happens all the time. People can say things almost really overtly, but we still don't register.
No, I didn't register at all. And I literally was like, oh, okay, I'll be in. Yeah, grand, no problems. He's taking a turn for the worst. It'll be fine. I'll go in and
finished
chat.
Your cup of tea.
Almost, except for as they were leaving, they said yes. And as I was hanging up the phone, I remember the person said, yes, he's had a cardiac arrest. Now, I am a doctor, and I hung up the phone, and that jolted me, because the number of people you get back from a cardiac arrest is...
Now that's different to a heart attack, right?
That's when your heart actually stops.
Yeah.
You're clinically dead.
Yeah.
And we do go, you know, clear, and you do all the paddles and all that. That's what a cardiac arrest is, and the CPR and all that stuff.
So I think a lot of people don't actually know the difference.
No, and they're totally different things. Yeah. And it jolted me, because I know all the stats and I know that less than 10% of people survive a cardiac arrest. And immediately I went, he's arrested. And my doctor head was now fighting with my kind of daughter head, because my daughter head was still going, this is grand, this couldn't mean anything. And my doctor head was kind of going, but sure, nobody comes back from a cardiac, like, or it's in single digits, the percentage of people that come back from a cardiac arrest. And I went, oh, okay. And then I was like kind of, but then I still didn't think Dad was dead or dying. I was just completely confused. And my brother-in-law was there, because he had actually collected us from the airport.
And I said, I've got to go to the hospital. Dad has had a turn for the worst and he's had a cardiac arrest. And like, we didn't plan this right. We didn't organise this right. We didn't do anything. So Owen was kind of like, oh, I'll stay here with the kids. And Connor brought me. So Connor left me at the door. So I was literally at the door of the matter on my own at 3 o'clock in the morning. And they'd been trying to ring other family members too, but they couldn't. Everybody was asleep and nobody woke up. So I was there by myself. And I was.
So your mum wasn't there either? No. It was literally just you?
No. And actually what I said to Connor, my brother-in-law, is maybe we need to get my mum then too. And he goes, well, tell you what, I'll drive to your mum's house and I'll ring the doorbell and see what we can, I'll try and wake her.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, okay, yeah, good one. It was all kind of, you know, chaos in a way because we weren't, it was sort of a crisis.
It's almost like a dream that you're watching.
Even when I'm remembering this back, I'm not sure if I'm describing it very well because it was dreamlike. Yeah. But I got to the door of the hospital and it was locked because it was the middle of the night. And I kind of knocked on the doors and the porter opened the door. And I remember he said, Kelly, which I found very ominous because he knew my name. He was obviously expecting me now. He probably would have expected me anyway. But I was like, yeah. And he goes, fifth floor or whatever, you know, sent me wherever I was supposed to go. And I was going, oh, Jesus, he knows. It was all these little things that were registering at me as these seem very not good things. But I got to the ward and I remember there was a nurse on the ward when I arrived on and she said, are you your Brendan's daughter? And I said, yes. I said, where is he? Can I see him? And she said, come on into this office. Ugh. And I said, I want to see him. Where is he? And she was going, we nearly had a standoff in the corridor because I could not compute what was being said. She was going, come on into the office. And I said, where is he? I want to see him. And she and so I just kept sort of repeating this kind of mantra, where is he? I want to, I think I did. Maybe I knew what she was going to say, but I didn't know how to.
You knew at a certain level, but the rest of you was still.
But anyway, surprised. Eventually, but the poor woman, because I refused to go into the office, I was more like kind of going, where is he? She told me in the corridor, your dad's dead. And I just then kept saying, I want to see him. You know, I didn't react in any kind of real sense to it. And so she brought me in and it was awful. I was on my own and he was, you know, the way in the bed and they kind of have you laid out or whatever. The sort of, maybe laid out is the wrong word. I don't know. But anyway, sort of hands on your chest, kind of looking like you're dead. He was dead. I don't know how to, but there was a little nightlight over his head and stuff. And he was in a 3 or 4 bedroom ward. And I remember I went in behind the curtain and I put my hand on his arm and he was still warm. So I felt a bit bad because I hadn't gotten there in time, even though I didn't know I was supposed to get there, really. But I felt bad because I've obviously just missed this. I've just missed him. He's not gone long. He's still warm. And I remember what I said out loud because it was weird. I said, Daddy, don't go. And I hadn't called my father Daddy, I'd say, in 25 years. Honest to God. I mean, I hadn't I didn't call him Daddy when I was 10. I'd say I probably stopped when about 6. And that's what came out my mouth, because that's who you're losing. You're losing the parent you had as a child. Do you know? Do you know the kind of way? So,
wow.
Yeah. Still quite sad.
That's nearly 20 years ago.
But then I had to go and tell all my family because they were all still asleep. So I had to. I actually rang my brother-in-law.
So Connor didn't get hold of your mum when he went.
I rang him. I said, "Listen, come back and bring me out to mum because." It's probably better she hears it from me. He was only going to get her to come in because Dad had taken a turn for the worse, but now Dad was dead. There wasn't really much of a hurry on it, and also probably better, you know, that I told them. But it was a horrible night, to be honest, but that's a long time ago. And yet, here I am. I didn't know I was going to be whinging.
It's allowed.
Yeah, it's funny.
If you can't cry in a grief podcast, where can you?
Yeah, exactly that. Exactly that. Yeah. But it was an awful, awful thing, and we were so shocked, all of us, because my dad, I'm quite like my dad, I'm actually quite like both of them in a way, but I would be quite like him. He was full of energy and he would have done a lot of things and he would have been very busy and he would have worked quite a lot and had a kind of a career where he worked hard, but he had a lot of interests, so he's kind of on the go all the time. And he was 66. We didn't see it coming.
He was a young man.
Yeah, I mean, 66 now, I wouldn't consider old at all.
Yeah.
So I suppose that blindsided us completely. And I think that's what I mean about they were two very different deaths. Dad was in his 60s and literally dropped dead unexpectedly, even though I know he was in hospital, but we all just presumed he was coming out and the next, you know, he was going to be grand and he was going to have to do a bit of, you know, walking or whatever, you know, you do after a heart attack.
A bit of OT and he'll be totally grand.
Yeah. And so that
really touched as well, Ciara, just by that little voice that came out.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's so true that when we think of our parents, it is from a very small place.
Yeah.
You know, and we grieve them from that small place again.
Absolutely. Yeah. But that came from nowhere. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And I was on my own, so I was only talking to him. And I did not know I was going to say that. And I surprised myself that this is the voice that came out. But
just the vulnerability of the situation as well. And you had your doctor's hat as well as your daughter's hat.
Yeah.
Most people don't.
True.
You know, most people don't.
The doctor's hat made it harder in a way to process the grief, I think. And just last word saying, it's two very different deaths. So young parent dropping dead, blindsiding the whole family. We were in shock, really. Mm. And whereas my mum was the dementia death, which was the slow, the long goodbye, the you're losing them piece by piece.
Yeah.
At a much older age, because that big gap between them. And I think those two things, you know, you could compare and contrast. I used to think, and I think it probably is much more brutal and much more shocking to lose somebody like that, but possibly for the person who dies, it's better. Now, I wouldn't wish it on somebody at 66, but I think there is a lot to be said for the dropping dead. Compared to somebody like my mum, who would have gone downhill slowly, and seen her life get smaller and smaller and smaller over time. So that
it's a theme we've talked about actually on the podcast. Is
really
what harder are we doing by prolonging people's life?
Don't mind me. You should have. Oh, you do.
I do have tissues.
You do have tissues, Liz.
Of course, I do.
Oh, I'm going to blow my nose now on microphone. Apologies to your listeners. So all of that happened.
Know that most people listening in to Shapes of Grief are sitting with tissues beside them looking for...
Sorry, folks, about that little breakdown there, but yes.
But they're looking, that's what people are tuning in for. They're looking for people who've walked the path and to resonate with what they're going through.
It was desperate, really, that death was harder to deal with. But having said that... Looking back now, I think, yes, harder to deal with for those left behind, probably easier for the person who died. Although
if you
I would
were to choose a death.
Yeah, I think I would choose his death, although I'd prefer it not at 66. I'd prefer it maybe many, 25 years down the line, whatever. But I do think there's a lot to be said from he lived his life like go, 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 and then died. Whereas mum didn't have that experience. She had a very different sort of slow slipping
and
away.
I want to come back to your mum as well, but before we do, you mentioned earlier how your first experience of bereavement really changed you as a person as a doctor. Will you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I did say to you there, you said I had two hats, the daughter and the doctor. I think I went into doctor mode a little bit after Dad died, as in I became quite practical and supportive of my family and watched them and sort of said all the right things that I would say to anybody who was bereaved. And I don't think I really acknowledged that I was bereaved.
So you went into role?
Yeah, I went into role and I you know, spoke calmly and supportively to other people who were struggling. But I think as a consequence, I wasn't processing it myself. So I think it hit me a little bit later. I kind of, some weeks or months went by, and then I was suddenly like, oh my God, Dad is gone, kind of thing. So I think.
And you had a new baby at home.
Yeah,
you had a 3-month-old baby.
Yeah, I did too.
And a toddler.
Yeah, I had all of that. It was awful.
And I think it's an important theme, actually, just to mention, like, because I know from a lot of my friends who are doctors, the roles that their families sometimes expect them to take on, or they just take them on because they think that's what they have to do.
Yeah, I don't know if my family expected me to, or if I did it, or if it was, you know, there's a comfort in the familiar. And I am a doctor, and I was certainly in clinical practice then. And it was, you know, I had certain skills that I could kind of use and tools that, you know, I'd be kind of would be okay dealing with other people who were upset or bereaved because of my job. I just think it made me not really look at myself. I wasn't very introspective on it, and I think it took a longer time to get over it as a consequence, and maybe that wasn't a good thing. But when you're asking me, did it change me as a doctor? Yes, it did. It definitely made me better. It made me, because I don't think I really understood how bad bereavement was till I'd experienced it. I kind of thought, in my naivety perhaps, or in my, just I was lucky, I thought that when people lost their parents, it was probably really, you know, horrible and all that. But you kind of got over it, and you kind of got, you know, it was one of those things, and you kind of would expect it really in life that these things happen and all, you know, that there was a certain path that people would walk, and it was probably not. I had no concept of what it was actually like for a truckload of grief to hit you and floor you. You know what I mean? I had no concept of that at all. That was unexpected. I didn't know that was coming. And as a consequence, I then understood much better when people came in to me. I had thought I understood their grieving process, but I didn't really. I didn't really till I went through it. And then I went, oh my God, it's so much worse than I had ever understood it to be.
My sister-in-law is 52 and lost her mother last year. And she's also a GP. And I remember asking her recently, how are you doing? And she just turned to me and she said, I had no idea. I mean, she's lucky she got 50 years of life.
I have no parents experiencing now, and I'm grief. In my 40s, and I barely know anyone with two. And I know quite a lot of people with none, like myself. And I, you know, I miss it. I miss having parents. I would love of a Sunday to be able to have Sunday lunch, or at Christmas, or, you know, those occasions in life that you want your parents to see your kids doing something or whatever.
Well, especially now,
I'd love that.
You said your youngest is 10.
Yeah.
You know, so now it's like you're coming up for air again from that early years mothering, and they're not there.
No. And I miss them both. They're very different characters. I miss them both a lot. They, you know, and it's a shame. And in a funny kind of way, the role your parents fill in your life, and probably the same way lots of people have different roles in your life, but the roles your parents fill in your life are almost irreplaceable, because they have your back in a different way. You know, I wouldn't say nobody has my back now, because there are people who do. But your parents, how they have your back, is a different way.
It's unconditional. And you don't have to pay them back.
And it's protective.
Yeah.
And it's kind of almost sometimes annoying how they would tell you to be careful about this or careful about that, because they always err on the side of caution and protection and all those things. But it is a security blanket and a safety net. I felt like there was a roof over my head when they were here, and when they were taken away, there was nothing between me and the sky, so anything could fall on me.
I remember a friend of mine saying to me about a month after my mother died, no one will ever love you like your mother does. And I remember thinking, thanks, Raquel.
Jesus.
I'm 33. I have a lot of years left. I'm not sure I needed to hear that.
I'm not sure you did either. Having said that, there's a truth in that. Doesn't
there
mean nobody will love you as much, or nobody will love you in a powerful way. I think, though, nobody will love you in the same way as
Absolutely.
A mother.
Absolutely. It is irreplaceable.
Yeah. And, you know, I miss them both. Yeah. I wish they were here. They're not here, though. There's nothing you can do about it.
And to rewind, Kira, to the truckload of grief, how would you describe grief? Because there may be people listening who have not experienced it yet.
I wrote a piece after many years after my dad died, and I tried to articulate some of this in that article. And it was a funny article.
Actually, I'll link to that in the description, if I may.
Of course, yeah. And I've written quite a lot about my mum's death, and I've written quite a lot about dementia, but I wrote about dad's death too. And it almost wrote itself, the article, although I think it's not probably coincidental or accidental, maybe, that I wrote it so many years after he died. I don't think I could have written about it with any kind of objectivity at the time. It did feel like a truckload of pain. I felt a lot of different things. There were aspects of it that just felt, truthfully, like fear. Like I was afraid of going forward in life because I didn't have him. And so I was afraid of living in any real way without him there, because we were actually very, very close.
You probably know that quote from C.S. Lewis, do you?
I don't know.
In his book, A Grief Observed, nobody ever told me that grief felt so much like fear.
I think I wrote something very similar to that, and I'm not sure I'd ever heard that quote before, yeah. But nobody ever told me that grief felt so much like fear, and it did feel like fear. Yeah. It felt like fear. I was afraid of life. I was afraid of going forward. And I realised that I had been actually quite dependent on Dad, insofar as that he was someone I checked in with every day. We would have talked on the phone sometimes more than once a day. I would never have probably taken any major decisions without talking to him. Do you know, everything from buying a car, you know, all those kinds of things. I'd run it by my dad. What do you think about this, Dad? And he was quite a traditional dad, kind of a parentally paternalistic-y kind of dad. He was quite, oh, you should do this and you should do that. And so it was like having a rock that you could always kind of touch off of and be mentored
by. He was
by.
Your go-to person.
Yeah, in a lot of ways he was. And so I think I had a terrible attack of fear about how I might live without him there to kind of bounce things off. I also think, in addition to the fear, it was a bit like there was a pall cast over everything. So yeah. I could have been with you having a lovely cup of coffee on a beautiful sunny street in Rome, and wonderful, we could be in a wonderful situation, and I would feel a sadness inside. I could have been watching my children playing in the waves in a beautiful, you could be in the most idyllic situation, and I couldn't quite get out from under this kind of a sadness. So there was a definite pall cast over life. It's like as if you were walking around, and even though the sun was shining, there was a little, like in a cartoon, a little cloud over your own head that was raining down just on you. I felt that. And I did have the fear thing, and I felt a real loss. I felt there was a real hole in me that I was going to have to try and fill slowly with other things over time. And it was a very slow fill. I would say a year on from his death, I was still in the throes of it. And I would say 2 years on, I was only marginally better. I think it was a full 3 years for me. People say grief takes, I don't know, about a year is what I think I had been told. But I think it was about 3 years before I was able to feel happiness again. Do you know what I mean? And I don't, I think...
Or a semblance of normal, whatever
normal
is. Yeah,
no, I think is. Happiness. I think that the pall lifted. And I think I didn't know it was going to take that long. And I think a lot of doctors, when they hear somebody say things like that, they say, well, you're depressed. I think I was just very sad and very grief-stricken. And I don't think it was something that needed to be medicalized or treated like it was a pathology. I think that was how long it took me to be able to embrace life again fully. I think the hole was too big for a while, and I think the loss was too acute for a while for me to be able to do that. And I also think there were stages of grief. I think there is the shock in the beginning. I was completely shocked. I think there probably was the anger. People talk about anger. I think there was probably a degree of denial. I know I went through a phase, and I'm going to make myself sound maybe a little bit mad, but I think it's never only you. If you feel something, other people always feel it too. I remember I would often expect him to appear to me. And I'm, by the way, an atheist and totally unreligious, and I don't believe in an afterlife even. So I believe in nothing to do with this. But I thought he would appear to me in some way. So
you were looking for signs or some sort of connection.
So if I was in a crowd, I would expect to see a glimpse of him in a crowd. Or I know that I would sometimes, I was living in town at the time, and the sink in the kitchen was at the window. And we didn't have a dishwasher, it was really annoying. And I would just wash the dishes. And I'd look out into the night, into the yard. We had a kind of a backyard. And in the shadows, I would expect to see something. And I never saw anything.
And would you will him to come?
Oh, I would have liked him to have come.
Yeah. Would you ask him or call, if you're there, show me a sign?
I don't know if I did that. I can't remember if I did that. But I know I kind of hoped he would come and thought he would come, but he never did, obviously, or maybe not obviously, but he never did. And I think that certainly hardened my atheism, because the fact that he didn't come made me think, okay, I kind of thought there was nothing, but now I'm pretty sure. And that was a journey that I kind of went on after his death. But I do think there was degrees. I think there was a degree of anger, but if there was, it was mostly misdirected anger, as in, there was definitely some people in my life who probably through no fault of their own, I think that I pushed out of my life in the period after he died, because I would feel angry with them. But with hindsight, that was probably misdirected anger, because I was like a wounded animal and therefore was reacting badly to things.
And that's exactly what it is. Like, it is like being a vulnerable, wounded animal. And I think,
but I didn't know that at the time.
Yeah.
I was full sure people had let me down in some way or whatever, the crap that you kind of go, you know, that stuff. And the other thing is, as I started to come out of the grief process, I felt a bit of guilt because I wasn't sure that it was right to let go of the grief, because the grief connected me to the person.
Yeah.
And if I let go of the grief, it was like I was letting them go. And so I had that, in the end, all I had was the grief. But little by little, I couldn't help it. I had to let go of it. And also what I...
Or allow yourself to feel joy again. Is,
what I realised I did then was I reconnected, as it were, with happy memories, you know, fun times and good things. And I could remember those without pain. That's what I have now. I obviously got a bit upset talking about the night he died, but in the main, if I talk about my dad, I wouldn't be upset.
Of course,
I would remember funny things or happy things and all of that stuff. And
I think that's the objective for most people. You know, I would see in grief therapy, well, what's your objective? Where do you want to get to?
Yeah.
And for most people, that is what they say. I want to look back with happy memories and love rather than this excruciating pain.
Yeah, and I think you do get to that point. I certainly think I got to that point, even though for a long time I only had the excruciating pain. So I know the excruciating pain, and it is excruciating sometimes, awful stuff. And I wrote this too. There was nights when I would go downstairs into the kitchen and close all the doors and kind of wail, not don't even mean cry, kind of almost keen. I'd make a noise and I'd go down there because I wouldn't want anyone to hear me, because I would have had small children asleep and a husband asleep upstairs, and I'd be like, oh, sneak down here and kind of wail in distress. And I'd say that is quite a common thing, even though people don't talk about these things.
It's like, because your soul is wounded when you lose someone.
But
you
see people around the world, you know, on the news, if they lose somebody in war, or not that I lost anyone in war, but you know, you see people in the throes of death and grief wailing, and it's not even crying, it's a painful cry, but
it's
not,
from
I don't mean
your
cry,
of your stomach, it's all of that.
And I know I did that sometimes and just kind of was like, oh my god, trying to get through this. But that's a long time ago, and you do come out the other side. And now, apart from when I was obviously just talking there about the night he died, when I do talk about him, I talk about him with great love and great joy and great memories, and I tell my kids lovely things about things. And same as my mum, when I talk about my mum, as I say, it was a very different death. That it wasn't as painful losing mum. I think there's probably something about first death and second death too. I think you're a bit more
equipped
maybe, is that the word, on a second death, but also, as I say, older, frailer, dementia, all of that. That seemed to me like, even though it was sad and we were upset and everything, it was timely. And you know, I remember saying to her on the night she died, I was there that night, and she was not agitated, she was quite calm and peaceful in the bed, but she, once or twice, she looked around and she wasn't talking at this stage. And she kind of looked, and she looked a little bit, not quite distressed is an overstatement, but she looked a bit nonplussed or something, looking around the room. And I remember I had my hand on her arm and I said, it's okay, you can rest now. Do you know what I mean? She didn't have to stay. I felt that if she wanted to go, and I kind of, we were in that, you know, we were in death's waiting room at that stage. I was like, it's okay, you can go. Don't feel that you can't. And she kind of settled, and she did, and her breathing went, and she stopped, and she, you know, she died.
Were you alone with her?
No, God, no.
Family were there?
Yeah. No. That was a very different thing. We knew. Again, I still didn't really expect her to die.
I was going to say, you knew at what level? But
exactly. That's exactly. At what level did you know? I knew she was going downhill. She'd been going downhill for about 2 weeks. Little by little. And I was in work the day of the night she died. She died after 12, so it was really the next day. But I was in work as a GP, and her GP was my partner in work. And she said to me, are you going to go and see your mum this evening after work? And I said, yeah, I will in a while. Yeah, kind of, you know, doing paperwork and stuff. And she kind of paused and didn't really say anything for a minute. And then she said, I think maybe you should just finish up and go and see her. She said, she's not great. And I kind of looked at her and I went, okay, yeah, okay.
Where was she, Ciara? Was she at home?
She was in Airfield here. Okay. She's in a nursing home very close to your house. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, yeah, great. I'll just finish up what I'm doing. And she went out of the room and I was processing what she was saying. And I realised, I was processing in the back of my mind what she was saying. As I was, you know, looking through blood results and all the things you do at the end of a surgery. And I went, oh, Jesus. I think she's saying what I think. Oh, and I looked at all the blood results and suddenly I couldn't concentrate on them at all. Mm. And I got up and I went out and I said, there's stuff on my desk, there's paperwork. I haven't finished it. I'm going to go down to the nursing home to see my mum. I can't sort of do any more. And I kind of walked out the door of the surgery, which would be unlike me not to finish up the day's work. I kind of just literally abandoned my paperwork on my desk. I'm sure it was fine. I'm sure somebody picked it up and finished it for me the next day or something. And I went down, and when I got there, I realised, this is not good. Mum is near the end. And so, and then I got Owen to bring the kids down, and the kids were there, and they got to, it was nice. And my I have a sister and a brother, and you know, there was people there and all that sort of stuff. She died later in the night, so they were all gone at that stage. But it was still nonetheless peaceful, and it was just a very different experience of death, I think.
And it's still shocking, like you say, when somebody...
Oh, I was a bit shocked.
Even when someone is dying and their breathing is very, you know, their breaths are very far apart, their pulse has gone down, it's very different to see somebody who is alive and someone who's dead. And there's almost nothing in the middle.
You're absolutely right. I think you have that thing where, what would you even say? I remember the first time I saw somebody being born, and it was the same kind of... incomprehensibility. I remember it was actually, believe it or not, in a hut in Java of all places, because as you do as a medical student. But anyway, and there was a woman in labor and we were there ostensibly to help, but sure, we were pretty much clueless, I'd say. But anyway, and she was kind of in labor on this bed thing and writhing around, and there she was one, and then, you know, a couple of minutes later there was one on the bed, and then there was two on the bed. And I remember thinking, this is really weird. This is the moment of a life, this is the moment of a birth, this is the moment of this little baby's life starting. And I found it very hard to get my head around it. It's the same thing. Somebody is there in the bed and they're alive, and then they stop. The breathing stops, but they stop. They just stop being. And it's sort of mortality and the concept of life and death is so huge that I don't know that we can really get our heads around either end of it, start of life or end of life. I think it's very hard to really have any true grasp of the hugeness.
And if we did grasp that this life is such a short little blip in the grand scheme of things, how do you think we'd live differently? Or would we?
I don't think I would live much differently, because I think I live as if my life is short anyway. I am somebody who is weird enough that I view life as a ride that I have to squash as much into as possible, and I kind of do. But I don't think I would live much differently, because I do feel I'm kind of doing what I want to be doing. Do you know what I mean? So I don't feel, if only, and I don't have a huge amount of regret about anything. And I don't kind of think, if I had have only done this, then I could have done that. I don't really have that.
And I imagine that you wouldn't be someone who'd sit around looking at regrets. You go, well, what can I do differently now?
I would, you know.
Yeah.
I kind of, to me, if you've done whatever you can to make something happen, but maybe it will happen, maybe it won't happen, but if you do what you can do, it's that like thing your parents always tell you, if you do your best, it's good. But I think if you do what you can do to try and do the things you want to do, well then what can you, there's nothing more you can do than that. And so I've been quite lucky in a lot of ways, and I know that but I don't think I would live much differently, even if I was to die tomorrow. I think I would be okay with how I've lived up until now.
You could look back and say, that's been okay.
That's been okay.
Yeah. That's lovely to be able to say that. Kira, I want to read something from one of your articles,
oh,
if that's okay.
Yeah, do whatever you want.
And actually, I have two lovely quotes that you wrote. I'll read this one first. You say, and this is from your article on grief, if you went on holidays last May, it would seem like a lifetime away and something that you can barely remember now. But the weird, slow journey of processing your feelings after a loved one dies moves at a snail's pace in my experience. So I think I'm only just getting glimpses of what it means to me now. It's like there's a veil over the loss that my mind has thrown up protectively, and I only pull it back occasionally and briefly and look at and feel the sorrow in small, bite-sized, manageable chunks.
Yes. Did I write that? I probably did. It's very odd when you hear your own writing read back to you.
Yeah,
I think what I meant there is I dipped in and out of it. Do you know what I mean?
This was following your mother's
death. Yeah, I think I dipped in and kind of went, ooh, that's horrible. And then I'd get on and keep going with normal life. And then I'd go back and look at it again. And I think I did do it that way on Mum. I wasn't able to manage it that way. It was too overwhelming on Dad. But I think on Mum, I managed it differently. I think I was much better prepared for it.
And I have this image of you when your dad died with a 3-month-old baby, a toddler. It's your first big experience of grief. And just how consumed.
I was totally consumed. Was I 30? I think I was 30. Maybe I was 31. I was younger.
You were young.
Yeah, I was young, and I did that. And a couple of months after he died, I put my house on the market. I moved from Dublin, from town, from a very urban kind of young life, out to Greystones, bought an old fixer-upper that was almost broke us in every sense of the word, financial, emotional, physical, every single way. Got builders in. They said it would take, I think, 6 weeks or 9 weeks or something. The house was derelict, had to be gutted. It took 13 months. We lived with my mother for that period of time out of boxes. While she was also newly widowed, it was hell. It was a hellish time. So that was all consuming and overwhelming. But I think with Mum, I went there and I had enough ability to go to the land of grief and process for a while and then leave again and come back into my life normally. And then I'd visit it again from, you know, with little gaps.
And what's your relationship with grief like now?
I have a lot of respect for it because it's awful, and I would never like to experience the crushing sort of grief I would have experienced when my father died. I'd hate to do that again. Having said that, you can never know that you won't. And in the same way that I would say my father's death was the worst death because he was younger, it was all the things, it was shocking and all of those, and it was the first one, I'm sure that could be trumped by a death of a child or something like that. I do think so. And the awful thing about grief is there's no way around it. You have to go through it. So you can't just, you know, shortcut it some way. I don't think you can shortcut it with pills. I don't think you can shortcut it with anything. Counselling, maybe that might be helpful, but I still think you'll have to go through the process.
Counselling doesn't heal grief. Nothing cures grief.
No, I don't think it does. No. I think time helps it, but
what you do in your time.
I do think that you still miss them. Right. I think I still miss both my parents to this day, though, so I think it's a horrible thing. But I have huge respect for grief because it's awful. And I think probably Dad dying was probably the worst thing that's ever happened to me. Mum dying wasn't great either. But I think Dad dying was the worst of it, as in the effect it had on me.
You talked about being so vulnerable and being like this wounded animal, and, you know, the anger that comes and we push people away.
Yeah.
because they're not good enough or they're not able to meet us. Could you talk a little bit about that, Kira, about who did show up, who was able to show up, who did you feel you didn't have to push away, and why?
I know, I mean, I certainly had friends and family that wasn't an issue with, but I think I reacted badly. I think what the grief did is it really put my focus on the negative. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
So I saw life through this prism of negativity. So if somebody didn't, things that would happen, I can't even think of a really good instance of it, but I know I would feel hurt maybe or angry with somebody who would have done some nothing thing, you know, they didn't invite me for coffee or something, you know, and they'd have gone with somebody else or something, you know, these kind of little perceived slights that now, if it was to happen, I wouldn't even notice. I wouldn't be kind of going, oh, they went for, that wouldn't register because I wouldn't be, it would be such a non-thing. Through the prism of negativity, I think I saw a lot of things as me being hurt or something, but I think I was just hurting.
You were on guard, perhaps, yeah, saving yourself from any other hurt.
Confirmation bias. I think I was hurt permanently because of I was grief struck. And so therefore I perceived things to be hurting me that really it wasn't about those things at all. It was about me not being in a good place.
Yeah.
And so I was a little bit unlike myself. In a funny way, I kind of deconstructed myself because I seemed to be very challenged on all of this. Like I felt an awful lot of, like I dredged old negative crap in myself out of everywhere. Like I put myself through the ringer. I put my life through the, you know, I kind of looked at it all with a very critical eye.
Grief does that, doesn't it? It brings everything up for renegotiation.
Yeah, but the only thing I would say in a positive, because I actually would generally be quite positive, is I think I reconstructed myself better. So I think I came out the other side better. I think I came out the other side stronger, more confident, more positive. In a funny way, one of the reasons I was so grief-struck by Dad dying was because he had been such a rock in my life and I had lent on him and I was a bit dependent on him and so the loss was huge.
Mm.
But him not being there, yes, I floundered, but I rallied. And then that showed me, perhaps, that I was independent, not dependent.
Do you think you internalized a little bit of his strength and took it on as your own?
I think now I show a lot of his traits. I think I'm quite like him in a lot of ways, although I'm quite like my mum too. We have a lot of personality traits of each other. But I do think there's a lot of him in me. And I just think I came out the other side stronger. I definitely do think, and I know, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger and that's all those things. But I do think I came out stronger and better and happier maybe than when I went in to it. I think I reconstructed with positives.
And I think it's a fair description. It's you know, you rip off a few layers with that vulnerability, but comes back as a bit more compassionate
resilient. I grew in some way from it. And I think the other thing that happens when you've lost both your parents, which is no one will tell you this either, you are liberated because you don't have any, as much as you don't have their support, you don't have the burden of their expectations. And I sometimes wonder what I have done in terms of throwing away a medical career that they put me through college for years. Would I have become a radio host had they still been alive? And they might not have thought it was a good thing to do. I mean, most people might not have thought it was a good thing to do, even though I wanted to do it. I don't know, like there is.
So there's something that's letting you breathe a little freely.
There is. Often in relationships that are supportive, there's also that can come with some degree of, it's like small towns are wonderful. If there's a death in a community, small towns are wonderful because they're supportive. But equally, they may be a little bit claustrophobic. Relationships are like that too. People carry the expectations and the burden of trying to please people in their lives that they love.
Without even realising
you do. You carry that fairly lightly because you love them and you're not thinking about it all the time. but somebody was saying something to me recently about, oh God, you did such and such a thing. And whatever they said, there it seemed to be, I can't even remember what it was that I'd done, but I remember thinking, God, yeah, I suppose I did do that. I wonder, would I have done that if my mum and dad were alive? And then I wasn't sure that I would. And then I thought, gosh, it's all, it's life is weird, let's be honest.
That's a great note to finish on. Life is weird.
It is.
Ciara, thank you so much.
No problems.
Really, it's so lovely having you here and hearing your story and your experience, all of it as well. Thank you for not holding back. Like
no,
I said, there's a
no
lot of...
No point in answering a question if you're not going to answer it properly,
yeah,
I suppose.
Yeah. I think people, you know, there's a lot at the moment about post-traumatic growth and resilience and the positivity of things. And, you know, it's just really important to look at the whole picture. Like, it's hard, it's scary, it's petrifying, and it can lead to great things. But it's all of this together, and you've presented that beautifully in your experience and in your story. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Shapes of Grief. This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical or psychological advice. If your grief is making you unwell, please do go to your healthcare provider. Grief is a normal part of being human. You are not alone. Join the Shapes of Grief community in our private Facebook group and find more support and useful links on shapesofgrief.com. Until the next time, from me, Liz Gleason, stay well.